Hi, and welcome to Last Man Standing. This is Sunday, the 30th of April, 2023. Bank holiday over here this weekend, as they call it, so everyone's off on tomorrow. Do support Republic Broadcasting Network. Just go to the homepage and you'll see the various options there to donate, keep us on the air and keep free speech alive and keep the truth being churned out, unfiltered. Anything else I need to say? No, just welcome to the show. And I think there's a possibility that my show will be changing to Saturdays rather than this really late slot, the last slot on Sunday. It's possible it's going to change to Saturday, 4 p.m. UK time, which is 10 a.m. Central and 11 a.m. Eastern time, which I think would be a better time slot, both for me and the listeners, because it's a very late show, and it's very late for me, and it means I always have to do pretty much a pre-record, or else get up at 6 o'clock in the Monday morning to do a live show, and then the only opportunity for callers at that point is people who are staying up really late or on the West Coast over there in California. So we'll see, but I think that's going to be changing to, again, Saturday, 4 p.m. UK time, 10 a.m. Central, 11 a.m. Eastern. Possibly we'll be starting from next Saturday, and then I can start getting some more guests on live as well, rather than doing pre-records all the time. And as I say, it suits me better with the time slot. All right, joined with the one and only Dr. Patrick Slattery today. Good to be with you, Patrick, and have you on with me.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be with you. Oh, by the way, on bank holidays, you said people are out on bank holidays. I have to do this. Are any people flying to the moon in a homemade rocket ship?
Well, you never know. Strange times, Patrick.
Do you know the reference?
No, I don't.
Wallace and Gromit, A Grand Day Out. I have to drop it. I have to drop that reference.
Yes, now you mentioned Wallace and Gromit, I'm with you. You're a big fan of Wallace and Gromit, are you?
I am an enormous fan of Wallace and Gromit. I'm actually, very nice. I've had emails remarking on my choice of bumper music, and maybe I need to play more Wallace and Gromit bumper music. I think that might be it.
Yeah, I think it's a positive step in the right direction, to be honest.
Yeah. I think so.
All right. One thing, I don't know whether you've heard this or not, it hasn't had a lot of coverage on mainstream media, but and I don't know what to make of it. It seems it's speculation. As far as I know, the Ukrainians haven't confirmed it, but on the Russian side, they have intelligence that the Ukrainians launched a drone, which was intended as an attempt on Putin's life. They got intelligence that he was going to be somewhere, and they sent a drone in with 17 kilograms of explosives, which was intended to murder Vladimir Putin. It dropped short. I think it had some sort of failure. It dropped short a few kilometers before its intended target. There has been a lot of big bombs being dropped, including in Kiev for the first time in the best part of 3 months since that. There's been a lot of strikes since that. Kherson has had a lot of strikes, and it seems that the Russians have, the Ukrainians have a very depleted air defense capability at the minute, and the Russians seem to be taking advantage of that, where they're just flattening all sorts of front lines and enemy positions, including making it very difficult for them to do this well talked about counteroffensive. But I just wondered if you heard anything about this attempt on Putin's life over there?
I have not heard anything about it. And I think, and so I don't know whether it was serious, who would have, who's exactly behind it, how far up the chain the decision-making goes. Obviously, I mean, I've been saying since the start that the purpose of cornering, of what's the best word, provoking Russia into this invasion of Ukraine, and I'm completely on Russia's side on this, was to lead to a situation where you could have crippling economic sanctions against Russia that aimed at toppling the Russian government under Vladimir Putin. And so, to me, like, yes, I think up to the very, very top, which means Victoria Nuland, who, you know, she used to be Joe Biden's effective boss on Russian policy. She was calling the shots back in the Obama administration in the second term, and Biden was there to pick up whatever corruption and graft he could get. The idea has been to get rid of Putin. So I wouldn't be at all surprised. But it does beg the question, what are these people thinking? What do they think is going to come after Putin? And, you know, Andrew Anglin had an article over the weekend about suggesting that Putin really should appoint a successor. But the thing is, it's not clear who would come after Putin if, let's just say, Putin was assassinated. Now, Putin being assassinated, that's not exactly regime change. You're assassinating somebody, but you've got the same leadership team. Who would emerge? But the if you were to have crippling economic sanctions that led to public unrest and an overthrow of the government, then you're overthrowing the entire team. And in that situation, what comes next? And have people really thought through what would come next? Because in the context of Russian politics, Putin is he's restrained, he's moderate. His critics consider him timid. So what do these people think would come after Putin? That's what I want to know.
Yeah. Certainly, Medvedev in his current position, like I've said before, he seems to be this kind of salivating Siberian wolf that Putin loosens the leash on occasionally, because every time you hear him talk, he's talking about don't doubt the fact that we will use nuclear weapons. There's been all sorts of, you know, this kind of very hawkish, disconcerting rhetoric coming from Medvedev and some others, and Prigozhin as well, about World War III and nuclear weapons, and we will use them if we need to, this type of thing. But when Medvedev was the president, I don't think he was as bold with some of his rhetoric, so who knows. But I think the mistake that people make is they seem to, you know, they buy into this propaganda and this narrative that literally Vladimir Putin and Vladimir Putin alone has, you know, completely runs the Russian Federation, and if they take him out, that the whole thing crumbles. And that's just not my understanding of how Russia is controlled. You know, as the president, and he has the final say, and, you know, is the, to some extent, the dictator in chief. But it's not entirely true that if they take out Putin, who has shown great restraint, is quite a measured individual, and is also, you know, probably more European in his thinking than some of the others that might follow him, because of his background, and he spent a lot of time in East Germany, and he's very knowledgeable and of how the West operates and how they think. But at the same time, it's unprecedented. Could you imagine if Russia had even attempted to take out Zelensky, which, as far as I know, to my knowledge, at this point, they haven't done, or had an attempt to take out Joe Biden, which, considering the U.S. involvement in that conflict, you could argue would be fair game. But this would be outrageous. But I it has been covered in a few media outlets. WeOn in India, RT have covered it, but I haven't seen anything of it in Western media. So I do think, though, that the two things are linked. It seems that the Russians, partly probably because of the depleted air defenses on the Ukrainian side, and because of this incident, they have hugely escalated the bombing campaigns and their firing missiles from the Black Sea. This type of stuff is going on, including, like I said, Kiev has been hit fairly hard, I think, in the last couple of months, or since in the first time in about 2 months, or maybe 3 months, you know.
Well, there has been criticism of Putin from even like pro-Russian people in the United States. And I haven't been looking into the Russian press that much. I wouldn't be surprised if there were criticism of him in Russia as well for not trying to take out the Ukrainian leadership. He hasn't. Weren't we talking about this? Weren't you talking about this a couple of weeks ago? That he was when all of this started, he kind of went into hiding, and then when he got a reassurance that he was not going to be targeted for assassination, then he went out in the street and kind of taunted and said, "Yeah, here I am, come get me," after he got the reassurance.
Yeah.
And as for, you know, Putin has always maintained support levels, you know, according to polling data, and you know, you have Western polling operations that are working in Russia, like, you know, the Pew, what's it called, the Pew Foundation, they work in Russia, and his support levels have always been like around 70%. Maybe they've gone as low as 60, but he's always had very strong support. And right now they're probably near record heights. He's Professor Stephen F. Cohen, who died a couple of years ago. He used a term that George W. Bush had used for himself. George W. Bush had a reputation as being an intellectual lightweight who wasn't capable of understanding issues or whatever. But once he, in an interview, said, "Look, I'm the decider." And what it meant is that, you know, he has the final word on things. Yeah, other people are coming up and formulating policy and maybe giving him alternatives, but he has the final say. It was kind of a funny word to use, but that's what Stephen F. Cohen said about President Putin. He said there may be a couple of two or three dozen people in the Russian government whose opinions matter. But at the end of the day, Vladimir Putin's the decider. So he was saying that to indicate that Putin's not a dictator, that it's not as if everything's coming from Putin. There are a lot of people whose opinions matter. But at the end of the day, Putin is the arbitrator of, you know, which opinions are going to hold sway. And, you know, lots of people find fault with him, but at the end of the day, he's done a pretty good job for Russia over these past 23-24 years.
Yeah, I think it'd be foolish of them to, for if there was any attempt to get rid of Putin, and I don't think there is. I think the frustration is, and we don't seem to understand that over here, is that the Russians, far from, you know, falling apart, and there's been all sorts of divisions, largely this attack, this Russia phobia that has swept through the West, has only garnered nationalistic fervor in Russia, and the only frustration with Putin is that he's not getting the job done more quickly and more aggressively, really. But yes, he has done a fantastic job there. There was something else I was going to say, but it's just escaped me. But other tensions are brewing with Poland and Russia. I did mention earlier, and I don't know what to make of it, how much credibility there is to this, but there has been this idea that maybe some sort of merger between Zelensky and what's left of Ukraine and Poland, which has obviously implications because, you know, that would in some way implicate NATO if there was some sort of, I don't know, agreement of cross-border, a removal of the border, really, to join Poland. I don't know. I can't see this happening, but there is historic... there is an historic claim on that land by the Poles. And this, what's his name, Uda, is it the Polish guy? He's very pro-Ukrainian and very hawkish and Russia-phobic. So we'll see, because these guys seem to be going into the history books and thinking there might be an opportunity to reclaim Ukrainian territory. But what is for sure at the minute is there's a lot of tensions around. There is a Russian embassy school in Warsaw, which the Russians obviously claim as their property, and it teaches Russian students. And the Poles have basically taken claim and taken control of that that school and said it's now part of Polish. It's the property of the Polish state. Medvedev actually, in response to this, said, and I'm quoting, "I see no point in maintaining diplomatic relationships with Poland. This state must not exist for us while there is no one but Russiaphobes in power, and Ukraine is full of Polish mercenaries who should be ruthlessly exterminated like stinky rats." So this is the type of rhetoric that...
it's funny that, that I mean, become... It's funny that Medvedev has become the bad cop, more than the bad cop, but like the bad cop's police dog, his German Shepherd, when this was who Obama and Hillary were trying to groom as Putin's successor. They because they thought he would be more pro-Western, to the point where when Vice President Biden had gone over to Russia late in Medvedev's term, and of course Putin was prime minister during Medvedev's term, Biden told Putin personally, you shouldn't run for re-election, or you shouldn't run for president again. Mm. But I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's fine. There's just these tensions have emerged now because of this. And I have to say, you know, the polls, I think they are a liability, because if anybody is going to trigger World War III, I think it could be the polls, because I think they're the ones who are most capable of going into Ukraine, which may trigger a response from Russia on Polish territory, which would spark Article 5. But I mean, I think on the Russian side, there's enough restraint there, and there already are. It's well known that out of everyone, there's more Poles in Ukrainian uniforms than anybody else from NATO. Whereas, despite the leadership who are constantly Russia bashing and sending all these weapons, there are huge marches in Berlin. There are huge marches in the Czech Republic against this whole thing of arming Ukraine and sending weapons there, and while inflation is through the roof and sending money there. I actually saw there was a protest. There was an MP in Moldova where he tore up the NATO flag, and they poured some sort of red ink over the NATO flag on the floor after it was lying there. So it's like the imagery is NATO has got blood on its hands. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of appetite among the people, understandably, for a war with Russia. But Poland, at least, again, their leadership, they seem to be very hawkish. You know, if they go in there, they're just going to get destroyed anyway. But I do worry about Poland. They seem to be the most likely to be at the center of some sort of escalation. And we'll keep an eye on it. But I thought I would mention that. What else? Oh, yeah. I don't know where you watched it. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has been chairing the what is the UN
Security Council?
It's the UNS, yeah, the United Nations Security Council meeting, which is they're chairing, and Israel walked out of this. So tensions are at an all-time low between Israel and Russia, and partly, I believe, you see, Israel. Apparently, this is some sacred day. I don't know. There must be some, some sort of sacred Satan worship, no doubt, that they have. They have some other name for it, of course, but it's some sacred. It's certainly not the God that I worship in Israel. The irony of the name of that place is just a complete counterfeit Israel. It's a satanic run state. Anyway, they are up in arms because there's some sacred day, calendar day, that this UNSC meeting in Israel were due to discuss their treatment of the Palestinians, and they asked for this to be postponed to a later date so it didn't clash with this, in quotes, sacred day. And Lavrov refused. Now, I think that the reason Lavrov refused is because Israel recently have committed to be sending in some early warning missile technology into Ukraine. So that's probably why. Anyway, the Israeli Gilad Erdan, the Israeli UN ambassador, he stood up and walked out and said, on this sacred day, this is a disgrace and I won't be part of it. And so the Israelis have walked out. But it's interesting because I think that marks an official end of decent relationships between Russia and Israel.
And what's interesting is that, Israel has a way outsized influence in America and Europe because of Jewish power in America and Europe. In terms of its economic prowess, for instance, or even its military prowess, it's much farther down the list. Yeah, I know it's got one of the biggest air forces in the world, but still, and for a small country, yeah, it's got some high tech and it's got an alarming amount of firms that are in information technology, where all of our say financial transactions, health. A lot of hospital systems use Israeli companies to manage people's health information, which is kind of scary. There's all sorts of stuff that goes on in Israel, but still, you know, it's a relatively small country.
Besides the United States getting holding, you know, having its back all the time, it wouldn't be able to throw its weight around like it is.
Right. And when a year ago, when it was still there, still might have been a possibility, or maybe 13, 14 months ago, still a possibility that the plan of getting unprecedented, of getting countries around the world to join in these unprecedented economic sanctions, when that still there might have been some hope for it. You know, Israel is a country, and Israel did not go along with the sanctions, by the way, to its credit or to its conniving, whatever. But it didn't go along with the sanctions, nor did most of the rest of Asia or Africa or Latin America. So, and you know, at that point, 15, 16 months ago, every country counted. And I'm sure that the Russian government was pleased that Israel was not going along with the sanctions. But I think this shows the confidence that they have now, where they're not going to, well, I mean, they're not going to postpone a meeting because of some holy day in Israel.
Memorial Day, that's what it's called. Yeah. They're not dancing to the Israeli stroke U.S. tune anymore, and they know just how closely linked Israel is. It may as well be a state of America, for God's sake.
Well, I mean, it's a weird relationship. I'm sure that even Texas or California couldn't throw its weight around the way Washington D.C. the way Israel does. So it's more than a state. It's more than the 51st state. You've got Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida. When was the last time he visited Austin, Texas, or Sacramento, California? But yet he's over in Jerusalem right now.
Yeah, I was signing legislation about anti-Semitism.
Yeah, and then he's back. And he's back. I'm not sure what his excuse for being back. I'm sure it's probably some sort of trade mission. But he's about to announce for president of the United States. So it's really fundraising and asking for support.
Hmm. Yeah, well, let's hope that scumbag doesn't get in anywhere near the White House after his anti-Semitism bill in Florida, which is a disgrace.
It is a disgrace. This is all a disgrace. Okay, you were talking about Poland and Ukraine, and so before we leave that topic and go somewhere else, if you look at maps over the years, you find and you want to pin down Ukraine's historical boundaries. Good luck. That's all I can say. Good luck, because it's constantly shifting. Sometimes there's an entity called Ukraine. Sometimes there's not an entity called Ukraine. What is Ukraine now? Parts of it were in this country or in that country. And you just go back century by century or major war by major war. The boundaries before, say, 2014 had been in effect not as international boundaries, but, you know, they had been as international boundaries since the breakup of the Soviet Union. They had been, in effect, as internal boundaries since, 1954, I believe, when Crimea was transferred to Ukraine. But then if you go back before 1945, it's different borders again, because that western part of Ukraine was part of Poland. And then if you go back before World War One, it was different again, because Poland was part of the Russian Empire. And, you know, you keep going back and everything, these borders change. If you were to go back, say, 300 years, I think 300 years would do the trick. You're going to find a big hunk of Ukraine was part of some entity like a Polish-Lithuanian entity, if you go back 300 or 400 years. And so it doesn't... Yeah, it doesn't have historical boundaries, and also even what is a Ukrainian? What does it mean to be Ukrainian? It differs. I mean, Zelensky. I mean, we know he's a Jew. He didn't even speak Ukrainian. I mean, he is a native Russian speaker, and has only learned.
It's not even really. it's not even a proper language anyway. No disrespect to Ukrainians, but it's a hodgepodge of some Russian in there. I think there might even be bits of German in there, maybe some bits of Polish in there.
Well, depending on there's a lot of Polish, depending on where you are.
Yeah, exactly. And, the places, whatever it is, I don't appreciate all our weapons being sent out there, and I don't appreciate all our money being sent out there. And quite frankly, no disrespect to them, but I don't appreciate, 10 million of them flooding European countries at a time when the we're already in trouble economically, and they get the red carpet rolled out for them. I mean, I guess it's not their fault, but it's an awful burden, and I guess we can blame the U.S. and NATO for provoking this war for that. I sometimes think, people say, oh, the poor Ukrainians had to leave Ukraine. Really? I mean, you've been there. If you had a choice, Ukraine or the UK, Ukraine or Germany. People don't earn a lot of money in Ukraine. The culture of corruption in that country is off the charts. I mean, it's normal to bribe doctors, dentists, whoever. You turn up with a little bribe, you're going to the front of the queue. The corruption is so bad in the country that, I've been watching a lot of interviews by these soldiers from Australia and the UK and others who go out there. And the whole military structure there, particularly at the start, maybe Zelensky's been forced to clean it up a bit because it's so embarrassing. But the whole military structure there, their generals and the people who are running the show, they're all part of a little criminal syndicate who are stealing weapons. And these guys wake up in the morning, their guns, their own personal guns have gone. Lorries disappear with weapons all over the place. So the corruption in the place is off the chart. So, I mean, I don't think the Ukrainians who have left are going to be in any great hurry to go back there, because the place wouldn't be out of place in Africa. In fact, it may even be an insult to Africa to compare it to that. The corruption is so severe in that place. And I know that. Russia is no angel either, and they've still got a lot of corruption there too. But I mean, I think genuinely Putin has been trying to go in the right direction with that, whereas Ukraine's just this Zelensky guy is just a con artist, talking about democracy and freedom when the place really is. I mean, it's an embarrassment to Westerners who buy into this, who are that ignorant to not realize the actual scale of just the general culture of corruption in that country. I mean, it's completely foreign to the way we live, but they act as if it's just, I don't know, the same as France or Germany or the UK or something. Anyway, I digress. And I don't appreciate whatever it is, it being somewhere which might spark World War III. I'm sorry, I don't want to have World War III for Ukraine or the Ukrainian people. I pity the Ukrainian people because they are victims. And if they would stop pointing the finger and have a little bit, zoom out and have a, educate themselves a little bit instead of this, over emotional reaction devoid of any context of the origins of that conflict, they might be able to remove Zelensky themselves and stop the Americans interfering. They had more peace in there before 2014. But, they are suffering now. That's what America brought you. How many dead young men have you got? Your population's probably dropped by about 10 million. Have you got any men left to have children with in Ukraine, Ukrainian women? And now that the gloves are off with the Russians, I get the impression that they're less worried about civilian casualties now. If there's going to be a couple of soldiers in civilian buildings, it seems the way it's going. They're no longer going in there floor to floor to remove the Ukrainian soldiers. It seems that they're just dropping big bombs on there now. And that if there's civilian casualties, the more I look at this, it seems that there are more civilian casualties mounting up. So this is what the United States and NATO have brought you, Mm-hmm. Sorry to rant and digress, but...
honestly, although I don't watch mainstream media, I have not been hearing a huge amount about civilian casualties. This is the type of thing that if there were lots of civilian casualties, it's the type of thing that they would definitely try to amplify. They'd try to harp on it as much as possible. I haven't been hearing a huge amount about it, but maybe that's just because I'm not paying attention to the mainstream sources. My one mainstream source was Tucker Carlson, and he wouldn't have been talking about that. So who knows? But the thing is, the longer a war goes on, the more increasingly callous military and political leaders are going to be in trying to minimize civilian casualties. It's the types of things that, like, maybe I'm wrong on this, but I think in, say, 1942, the idea of firebombing Dresden or nuking Hiroshima, it would have been a much harder sell than it was in 1945. I don't know. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Probably. And so the
yeah, by the way, back to
the worst it's going to be for the civilians, for sure.
Yeah, that's it. And again, you know, I think we have to remember the context of, you know, of Vladimir Putin and Russia. The Russians, they are outraged by this. And, the longer this goes on, the less they care, I think. They want this done. They don't want to be messing around. They don't want to be hearing about minimizing casualties and all the rest of it. They want this done, and they want Ukraine wiped off the map from... You know, and they want Kiev destroyed and Zelensky, you know, assassinated. That's the impression I get from what, you know, from any stuff I hear from inside Russia. But the Russians have, because there's this counteroffensive. Oh, by the way, one more point, because we were talking about, you know, what is Ukraine anyway. The Chinese ambassador to France recently caused a lot of controversy when he was asked, is the Crimea a part of Ukraine, for example? And he said it depends on how you perceive the problem. There is a history there. Crimea was originally Russian, and it was Khrushchev who offered Crimea to Ukraine during the period of the Soviet Union, to which there was all sorts of condemnation and outrage and triggered European globalist and Jewish puppet leaders, you know.
But that's absolutely the fact.
It is a fact, yeah. But Patrick, you're not allowed to state facts, you know. And by the way, if we're going to be looking at the presidents, you know, because I've been on some online forums and stuff like that. And people talking about this, and the people in the propagandized West, there's no point wasting your time trying to talk to them too much anyway, because it's just Russia bad, Russia bad, Russia bad. They harp on to you about how Russia invaded, you know, the Soviet Union, how Russia invaded Afghanistan, and blah blah blah. And you're like, yeah, okay, you have to go back to the early 80s for that, and that was long before Vladimir Putin's version of Russia. And you reel off all the countries that the US and NATO have invaded since, and they still maintain that NATO is a defensive organization. And the argument goes that Ukraine is a sovereign nation, and it has every right to join NATO if it wants to, and who are Russia to say otherwise? Well, there are geopolitical realities and just some sort of wisdom that needs to be exercised, and geopolitical realities which need to be observed. If the shoe was on the other foot, that we've talked about before with the Monroe Doctrine, the United States wouldn't tolerate it for a second, and everyone knows that. Yes, you know, this. There's a, you know, the other argument is that if you mention these things about Ukraine, the Crimea being part of the Ukraine and being part of Russia, what you get is, well, that was way back then, it's not anymore. So these are the same people that will call you an anti-Semite for saying Israel has a right to exist. I think Israel set the precedent when it comes to this reclamation of land, since you're talking about 2,000 years since they didn't have that land. But 2,000 years later, they kicked the Palestinians off that land and said, that's our land, you know, from 2,000 years ago.
Well, the thing is that the Russian government, and it was before Putin, it was the government under Yeltsin, when the Soviet Union broke up, the Crimea, which has very few Ukrainians in it, it's mostly Russian, and then some Crimean Tartars, who look Slavic, but there's some sort of link with the Mongols, with Genghis Khan, but they look European. That's the vast bulk of the population. There really weren't very many Ukrainians there. And within, I think, a few weeks of the breakup of the Soviet Union, Crimea, which was an autonomous republic, it had a high status within Ukraine. It was an autonomous republic within Ukraine. Their legislature voted for independence. And after a fair amount of negotiation between Russia, the Yeltsin government of Russia, and the Kravchuk government of Ukraine, Leonid Kravchuk, there was an agreement that Crimea would remain Ukrainian sovereign territory, and the military bases of Sevastopol would remain Russian military navy bases. So the status quo was observed, and the Crimean parliament froze or whatever. They rescinded their declaration of independence. And it wasn't until the 2014. So you have to figure that for what 23 years, the primarily Russian population of Crimea was tolerating living in Ukraine. But in 2014, with that coup, the State Department sponsored Victoria Nuland drawn up coup, the very day after Viktor Yanukovych, after he fled the country, you had this post-coup government. The very first thing they did is abolish Russian language schools and put all of these very harsh cultural measures, anti-Russian measures, in place, you know, linguistically, but really ethnically. And so the region of Ukraine that was the most ethnically Russian was, I'm pretty sure, it might have been Donetsk, but I think it was Crimea. They voted for independence, as did Crimea. I mean, as did Donetsk, as did Lugansk. And because of the sensitivity of the bases, and because of the higher autonomous republic status of Ukraine, and because of the history of the transfer of the territory by Khrushchev, the Russian parliament accepted Crimea, did not accept the other two countries. So the fact is, and this was a lot of history there, but that the Russian government under Yeltsin and then later under Putin, they were not trying to redraw boundaries. I think pretty much all of the various republics that emerged from the Soviet Union and even from Yugoslavia, there was reluctance to redraw, especially the Soviet Union, though. But there was reluctance to redraw boundaries because there would be no end to it. And even if it was only on paper, so even where, I mean, you had what was called frozen conflicts in areas that had been part of Georgia, Abkhazia and South Ossetia. You had in Bosnia-Herzegovina, you had in Moldova with the Transdniestria region, you had these frozen conflicts where there were, for all intents and purposes, breakaway regions, breakaway republics, but they were never officially recognized. Nobody officially recognized them because, at least on paper, they wanted to leave the map in place because there would be no end to redrawing boundaries. And that was the status quo until the United States and NATO countries decided they wanted to recognize Kosovo in what had been an autonomous region of Serbia, but they wanted to recognize Kosovo as an independent country. And Vladimir Putin was warning against it. He was saying, you know, this is a really dangerous precedent. And that was 6 years before the annexation of Crimea. That was 6 years before. And so this redrawing of the maps was not something that was started by Putin. It was started by our State Department.
Yeah. And of course, again, they're impervious to irony because the intolerance of those who identify as Russian ethnically and who speak Russian and see themselves as Russians and who practice in the Russian Orthodox Church, there's been an attempt to eradicate this. How severe it is depends on who you ask, but it's definitely a thing. And again, this would be like, I don't know, this would be like demanding that, I don't know, what would it be like in the West where we're so tolerant, except if you disagree with them, or if you happen to be from the white population. This would be like going into mosques and saying you can only pray in English.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's really hard to come up with analogies that are going to make any sense to Americans, because we haven't had this type of thing happen. It's very difficult. You can say, well, what if you know, you have to get into all these what ifs. What if Texas
stopped them speaking Spanish?
Well, yeah. What if the Texas declared independence and and then you had a coup in Texas and they insisted everybody speak Spanish? And then the people in the Northwest Panhandle decided they didn't want to be repressed by Spaniards in El Paso or whatever, and declared independence and wanted to be part of the United States again. You can say things like that, but it's just really hard for people to understand.
Yeah. One thing is, it was quite interesting, though, that just on the Crimea, because you still hear this narrative, you know, the Crimea being Ukrainian territory, even if you take away the history of it or whatever else, and it's territorial situation. The demographics of it, there was a journalist from MSNBC of all news channels went and did a piece in Crimea, a guy called Keir Simmons, who's a British journalist, even Ryan interviewing people, and they were all saying, we want to be part of Russia, and, you know, death to Ukraine, and, you know, and hail Putin. And so he came back and said, all these people, they're all Russians, they're all pro-Russians, they speak Russian, they want to be part of Russia. And this was apparently sort of like, you know, supposed to be some big shock to this journalist. Anyway, this, you know, this journalist ended up on the Ukrainian kill list, as you do.
Yeah.
So that was interesting, simply because it came from a British journalist, you know, working for MSNBC. They seemed surprised by this, but you know, again, the irony of these liberals, but this country's even worse. You know, they're so, you still see a lot of Ukrainian flags. They seem to think it's a great democracy. Putin's evil. And that's just the way it is. Anyway, the Russians, in response either to the attempt on the acclaimed attempt, assassination attempt on Putin, or both, this well-discussed and predicted Ukrainian counteroffensive, the Russians have been sending huge bombs and cruise missiles, which are decimating Ukrainian command centers and things like this. And they've very much fortified that whole eastern region, sort of east of the Dnieper River, with things like, they call them dragon teeth and all sorts of things. And as I say, they are taking full advantage of their air superiority, and lots of strikes in commanding officers of Ukraine's joint troops in Kherson and other places. So I don't know. I just don't see this counteroffensive amounting to much. And maybe when this hyped counteroffensive has either not taken place or is largely known to have been an abject failure, maybe this thing will be wrapped up. I don't know. I think one way or another, this war is probably not going to continue in its current form, you know, beyond Christmas this year, at least. I think it'll be wrapped up some way or another this side of Christmas, unless it escalates into a wider conflict. But it seems that the United States have sort of starting to already, you know, focus more on what's happening in Taiwan, you know?
Well, what I've been saying, I really haven't been talking about timelines, because to talk about a timeline, you have to have really the military information, the military expertise, which I don't have. I know the history better than most people. I'll say that. And, you know, I know the political situation. I know the ethnic situation. I don't know the military situation. So I haven't been using a timeline. All I've been saying since the beginning is that Russia will meet its military objectives. It will meet its military objectives. Of course, what those military objectives are, that's on shifting sands, because as this goes on and on, its military objectives become more and more grandiose. Its military objectives on the day this started, or at least before it started, was probably simply securing the independence and eventual annexation of Lugansk and Donetsk. But now you've got Kherson's in play. Now you've got Zaporozhye's in play, and potentially Kharkov and Odessa and Nikolaev. You've got other regions that are in play, and who knows what's going to happen? Who knows what's going to happen at the end? But I do think that there's nothing that's going to, in the long run, stop Russia from meeting its objectives. What is the long run? And I was thinking, you know, in terms of even last summer, well, this, everything could, because things were moving pretty fast. And I thought, well, this could happen anytime. The Ukrainian government could collapse at any time. And I still feel like it could collapse at any time, although it could go on for a while. Who knows? I don't know how long it's going to go for, but they seem to be running out, using up weaponry, using up air defense missiles and things like that at rates that they can't sustain, that the Western military industrial infrastructure is unable to sustain. And
yeah, they lack the surge capacity, apparently, that, you know, they can get the sort of weapons and ammunition that the Ukrainians need, but probably not for maybe 6-8 months, maybe a year, which is too late, whereas the Russians, in fact, when you, one of the themes of, and I listened to probably maybe 12 hours of footage, you know, of like reports from these soldiers that went out there, from, you know, Australia, and these guys get out to fight for Ukraine. I don't know why they're bothering. It's just, they're good soldiers, but their geopolitics is all over the place. And they're shocked by the corruption. But one of the themes that emerges is just the one guy described it as just like just seemingly unlimited, you know, artillery fire and mortars and missiles and rockets from the Russians, and they do it from a distance. And you hear these reports of just, you know, them going in there and maybe two companies being wiped out in one, you know, 5-10 minute exchange, and that's 400 men. So, you know, the Russians, they seem to have invested correctly in this IRS, this, you know, intelligence, reconnaissance, and surveillance technology, along with just an almost unlimited supply of artillery and rockets of all descriptions. And, you know, I think Douglas McGregor and Scott Ritter are now describing this as not only not a fair fight, but it's actually a humanitarian crisis for the Ukrainians now, such are the losses, you know. And yet the West, they'll sort of keep talking about this, you know, counteroffensive. And the Times Radio keep reporting, every time you see the Times Radio headlines, it's always, you know, oh, Russia are running out of ammunition, and the Russians are on the defensive as Ukraine prepare for taking back. You know, it's just so devoid from reality, you know, because these soldiers are telling a very different picture. It's very interesting listening to them. You know?
And, you know, the American or the Western public, they've been going along with this, thinking Zelensky's a hero. And of course, if you just take a step back and you realize, okay, Zelensky, how much does he identify with Ukrainians? Because he didn't even speak Ukrainian. There's a very pro-Zelensky half-Jewish professor at Yale who claims to teach the only college course in America on Ukrainian history. His name's Timothy Snyder. And I listened to all his lectures for his course last autumn. And he's very anti-Russian, very pro-Ukrainian. But he knows Zelensky because he goes over. He's a high-level professor in a relevant field. And he goes over to Ukraine for conferences and meetings. And he knows Zelensky. And he was joking that, yeah, Zelensky, his Ukrainian's getting better. Because when he became president, before he became president, he really didn't speak Ukrainian very well, to the extent it's a proper language. He didn't speak it very well. His career, he was speaking in, and his life, he was speaking Russian. So what? And he's a Jew. He's not ethnically Ukrainian. He doesn't speak Ukrainian particularly well. So what is his connection? He doesn't. He's just sending all these Ukrainians into a meat grinder, and they're dying. For symbolic purposes,
it's a genocide.
It really is. And you got all these people in America with their Ukrainian flags on their Facebook profiles, and they have absolutely no idea what any of this, you know, any background. There's zero background. Most of them couldn't identify Ukraine on a map. They have no idea what they're doing. Well, what they're doing is supporting a Jewish genocide of the Ukrainian people.
Yeah. And another story that's emerged as well, and I've heard this from some footage and, you know, from the horse's mouth of Ukrainian soldiers. Apparently, some of the first soldiers that they were keen to round up and send into Bakhmut particularly, which is a total meat grinder, is that the Russians, they've been sending in as many Russian-speaking, Russian-identifying Ukrainians, including even in the Donetsk region, to fight the Russians. So, you know, in other words, they're trying to cleanse the Ukraine of the Russian people, of the Russian-identifying people, by putting them into the Ukrainian military, forcing them into the front line, and getting them wiped out by the Russians. I mean, can you think of anything more tragically ironic than that?
And, of course, the Ukrainian people themselves, Ukrainian people... you wonder, because there's been enough history between the people who live in Ukraine, the Cossacks and whatnot, and Jews over the centuries, you wonder, shouldn't they be able to identify a Jewish government that's not acting in their benefit?
I
don't know exactly what the education would have been in Ukraine for these past, what's it been since the Soviet Union broke up, since the past 32 years? If they're, to the extent that they teach the Holodomor, who's responsible for it? Is it Russians? Is it Jews? Is it Bolsheviks? Is it communists? How are they spinning that? During the years of the Soviet Union, there was a lot of, a country doesn't want to teach that several decades ago it was making horrible mistakes, right? That's really tough. And so I can imagine that under, even in the 1980s, up until close to the very end, there was a lot of introspection going on, but up until very close to the very end, you would have had all sorts of whitewashing of what had happened in Ukraine. And so what would people have known? Now, people in the 1930s or 1940s would know because it was their own life experience. But, how much do you know about the life experience of your grandparents in the 1930s?
Not that much, but I don't know. I still find it very sort of frustrating and perplexing how these guys can't identify that Russia is no longer, the Soviet Union is no longer run by the Bolsheviks, and that the Bolsheviks have now hopped over to the West, are now controlling the West, and that they're pushing this war, and that they're actually fighting for the Bolsheviks and the Jewish interests. It really is perplexing to me how that can be lost on you, that you can go in there, like the Azov Battalion or any of these like uber Ukrainian nationalist groups who are mindful of the Holodomor, no doubt, and yet I seem to just and it's, by the way, it's the same in the Eastern Europe countries. They think they're liberated by joining the global homo Jewish West without seeming to identify that it's the same people that destroyed the Soviet Union and that caused their oppression that are now running the West. I mean, they've gone from the fire into the frying pan, but there's just this, even these soldiers that go in to fight for Ukraine, the common theme about them is it's hate Russia.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't really understand it. I mean, in this day and age of like so much information available, they seem to cling to this post-war World War narrative that the West don't indulge in propaganda. Only Russia does that, and we indulge in freedom. And I don't know. I see a lot of Eastern European girls who around here always seem to be with brown guys or black guys. So maybe they see this as a great liberation, so they can come to London and breed with Africans.
Okay. So how much time do we have left? So I know how much of a rant to go on.
You got about 2 minutes, 5 minutes, maybe.
5 minutes. Well, okay. So I'll take a couple minutes. This is, I can't imagine I'm the only person who's thought of this, but when it comes to women, evolutionarily, men and women, okay, every person had a mother and a father. So you've half of your ancestors are men, half of your ancestors are women. None of your ancestors are trannies. So you're inheriting stuff from both sides, but, so you're inheriting genes from both sides, but some genes are activated if you've got the Y chromosome and the male hormones, and other genes are activated if you've got the X chromosome. So you can have within the same species, you can develop specific behavior traits for women and very different ones for men, based on your environment, based on selective advantage. And so with men, I mean, you can look at genetic history or written history. When the territory of a tribe or whatever is invaded and taken over, the men no longer reproduce. They might be executed, or they might be castrated, but they no longer reproduce. The women do reproduce. They reproduce with the invaders. You could say maybe it's rape or whatever, but they reproduce. And so the the genes that resist invasion are going to be strong with men. The genes that resist invasion aren't going to be strong with women, because women will reproduce with the invaders. And you know, I'm not trying to badmouth women, but I'm just saying that this is the history of our species, and you can see evidence of it all over the place. And it's really why women shouldn't be involved in decision making about these issues, or at least to the extent they're involved, it should be with this knowledge.
I totally agree. And by the way, as a Christian, that's outlined that they shouldn't be. But the women are so affected by feminism today, they don't even realize it. Even women, they have unchallenged assumptions and you know, lifestyles which they wouldn't describe as feminist. But it's not normal for women to be well into their 40s, and it's a phenomenon with no children. And not only not have children, but they sort of – I've met girls who are in their late 30s who say, quote, I'm not ready for children yet. This is not normal. That is a sign that you have been infected by feminism. And yeah. The Bible says the man is the head of the household. And women typically are not supposed to be put in that role. They're too emotional, and they're because they have emotional responses to everything – because of their makeup, they are, you know, they're largely incapable, I think, of having a healthy judgment about things, including, for example, the origins of the this Ukrainian conflict. But you know, just generally, if you trigger them emotionally, decisions are made which are, let's say, not in the best interests of the nation or the West generally, and that is why I think launching women into the political and cultural arena has been a total wrecking ball, including with the demographic shifts and immigration and things like that, you know?
Yeah, it certainly has been. Well, is that about it?
That's about it, Patrick. We'll wrap it up there, but thank you very much for coming on. As I say, I might be changing my show. I'll find out later in the week to Saturday at 10 a.m. Central, 11 Eastern. Any closing thoughts?
We'll see. All I can say, we'll see. You know, I don't know. We do our best. Please keep us on the air, because honestly, there's stuff that you're going to hear at RBN that you're just not going to hear elsewhere.
I'll second that. That's absolutely true. All right. Thank you very much for joining me, Patrick. And you can join me again next week, as I say, on Saturday, probably. I'll be on with Richard Carey on Beyond the Official Narrative at midday tomorrow. And who knows, Patrick, we might end up doing a show later in the week.
Okay.
All right, take care and God bless. And thanks again, Patrick.
Thank you.
Talk Radio, only on the Republic Broadcasting Network.